Hello, and welcome to another episode of Not Quite Great Books, a TV podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Daniel Hanley, and joining me on the other line, he's invited himself not to dinner, but to this podcast, it's John McMahon.
Just intruding over all conversations, godly and law enforcement area, as is my wont.
Yeah, but we're not alone.
No, we are not, Daniel. Also joining us on the other line, the Stan to my Philip, or is it the Philip to my Stan? It's Jordan Cass. Jordan, wonderful. Welcome to Not Quite Great Books.
Wonderful. Thank you for that.
Do you identify more as a Philip or more? So I should tell the listeners, so Jordan is like one of my longest and dearest friends. And so we want to celebrate the true bromance of the Americans, or one of the true bromances, Philip and Stan. But do you identify more as Philip or Stan, Jordan, in our friendship or in life?
I feel like we are both more Philip, so I don't know if this holds perfectly well. but if I have to choose, I guess I'll choose a Philip here.
I have known Jordan for just a little while, like the prep of this podcast. And watching him and John interact, I feel like that is correct. You are both more Philip. That is very true. At least vis-a-vis each other.
Well, thank you for that intro. For anybody who doesn't know John, outside of this podcast, John is one of my favorite people in the world. One of the smartest, funniest, warmest people I know. Also, even if you know him through this podcast, you don't know that he gives the best hugs of anybody I know. So I was very sad.
To not
see him in person recently. So happy to see your face, though.
Ah, Jordan, the sweetest.
Also, I want to give about 10 caveats to this before I start. I've never been on a podcast.
Great.
I have not rewatched seasons 1 through 3 since I originally watched them, like the whole show, like 3 years ago. So the previously ons have been doing a lot of heavy lifting for me. I listened to 2 of your all's podcasts from this season, the most recent one, to kind of get me up to speed on what you all have been talking about. Mm-hmm. And I have very little familiarity with all of your esoteric theory and philosophy references. So I am
so
just here.
Jordan,
I have no idea what you're doing
than
here.
Danielle or I is what he just did. Yeah. That's a humble brag by Jordan to be like...
I'm not as crazy as you guys. Good.
Regardless, I'm very happy to be here.
We are so thrilled.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you. And also, luckily for you, all those caveats don't matter.
Jordan has already been anointed as the most prepared.
Most prepared guest.
But it's like Jordan, him or Mike. It's one of those two.
We have had multiple people on this podcast, many of whom are related to me. Multiple people on this podcast who have just never seen an episode of The Americans. They're just here for literally the vibes. One of my little sisters was like, couldn't be me. Couldn't have watched it. Like, what? So the fact that you didn't rewatch 3 seasons of The Americans in order to be on this podcast, we'll allow it. We'll allow it. We appreciate the thought, though. Now that we have given a good sense of who Jordan is and also, like, who Jordan is to John, what episode are we talking about, John?
We have today, with Jordan, the episode American Season 4, Episode 11, Dinner for 7, directed by Nicole Cassell and written by Joshua Brand. And Danielle, what is our nice, concise, brief IMDb summary this week?
If so you could concise. The IMDb summary for Dinner for 7 is: Elizabeth completes the last steps of a very personal operation, but at what cost? There's a very dramatic ellipses in the middle.
Jordan, so as you may or may not know, we've lapsed into making fun of the IMDb summaries for episodes. How would you rate this one on a scale of this is ChatGPT to like this is mid?
They're keeping it nice and vague and trying to give you a teaser here. I don't know, it seems mid to me, but it makes me want to know, what is the cost? Let's discuss some of those costs perhaps now.
Jordan, setting us up for segues. He's
a pro.
Sure,
you've
already
never been on a podcast before. You're a liar. That's my Danielle Dossier entry. Jordan's a liar. He is a podcast pro. He is faking us out. He's podcast pro. I've never been on a podcast. Okay, you just transitioned like a pro. Amazing. Let's get into it.
We might say, and I think this is what Jordan was hinting at, that one of the costs to Elizabeth, but also to many other characters this episode, is that this is an episode in which Jordan pointed out to us that there is a kind of pervasive sense of guilt. Would you say that's accurate, Jordan, across kind of the different characters or storylines and what have you?
I would say this is where sort of everyone's guilt has caught up to them in ways that had been, chasing them up to this point, and they'd been able to sort of self-deceive for several seasons up until this episode, and this is where that self-deception runs out, I think, for a lot of them.
Where do we start? Perhaps we start with Elizabeth as the IMDb summary, or as just, like, the character with probably the most screen time this episode, but also one, like, who has an array and diversity of feelings, I think, in this episode, but many of them guilt or guilt adjacent. So, Jordan, kind of what Elizabeth-wise most stood out to you in terms of, like, the way she is experiencing or realizing some of her guilt?
So I think this actually starts off with Elizabeth. Correct me if I'm wrong, it was the last episode where she was given that response or given that question from Gabriel about whether or not the center could potentially give another way in other than Dawn and Young Yi to getting this done. So she was already grappling with that guilt. And so at this point, there's still, when we first enter this episode, there's still that possibility that this operation isn't going to go forward. So I think that actually the guilt isn't foremost on her mind when we start with that scene. With when Pastor Tim comes over with Elizabeth and Philip in the kitchen, the first thing that happens is, Pastor Tim comes in, he's racked with guilt, he's remorseful, and the first thing that happens to Elizabeth is not guilt, it's, oh, how can I weaponize Pastor Tim's guilt against him?
Yeah.
And, like, there's this little look that, and so much great face work in this episode, but, like, I know, like, in the show in general, but this episode especially, Elizabeth gives a subtle little look to Philip that's just like, oh, we've got him. Like, this is our in. This is, like, we thought that we were screwed previously when Alice, came and threatened us, and all of a sudden the tables have turned and we can weaponize this guilt. And, like, that becomes an undercurrent of how do you use guilt, to your own advantage throughout the rest of the episode. So at least for me at this stage, this is very early in the episode, but at this stage in the episode, I think that Elizabeth's guilt is actually on hiatus again, and she's back to being her more calculating self and, like, how can I turn this to my advantage? Because that's what she has always done extremely, extremely well.
Yeah, and I think, like, I love that you pointed that out, because it's, like, guilt is, like, a key theme in this episode, but also the other thing sort of in play, like, as a function of guilt is, like, weaponizing vulnerability, right? And guilt is one of the ways in which vulnerability pops up, and one of the ways that Philip and Elizabeth are sort of like, okay, we can like jump in on this. And I think, like, where guilt really comes through for Elizabeth is around the, like, Dawn, Young He, like, situation. And you're right that, like, that first interaction with Pastor Tim, it's not her guilt, but it's his that can be, like, manipulated. And then, like, when it comes to the Dawn interaction, like, that is one that is colored, or, like, it is, like, preempted by her guilt. And then it is, like, we're also using guilt to manipulate here, too. So that's, like, that comes across not only with Pastor Tim, but also with Dawn, even though with regard to Dawn, she is, like, so much more, like, divided about it.
I think you're completely right. And I think in that scene with Pastor Tim, that is Elizabeth in her element. That is her in her comfort zone.
Totally.
She's now going back to what she's having to do with, like, now I'm going to kind of jump ahead to the following scene with Gabriel. Gabriel comes in with some, preemptive peace offering pierogies, knowing what he's going to have to tell Elizabeth.
Bad news, pierogi.
And like, now all of a sudden, Elizabeth has been thrown back out of her element, and she realizes, what it is that this means and what it is that she's going to have to do. And then now, to belabor the point here, now Gabriel's feeling guilty because he wasn't able to protect his agent. He's always thought, I think he's, more of an old school guy. And I think you guys had a conversation about this last episode, wondering if this was out of character for Gabriel. And I think you both came to the decision it wasn't too much out of character. It actually made sense. He's ultimately trying to, yes, he's serving the center, but he's looking out for the best interest of his agent here, even if from an emotional standpoint. And so he feels, I think, to a certain extent guilty that he's failed his agent in being able to find another way around other than taking this path that he knows is going to emotionally damage Elizabeth and that he knows Elizabeth knows now as well. And yeah, so this is now we've had this, you know, 3-5 minutes of screen time or whatever in this episode where Elizabeth is back to feeling a little bit safer and more comfortable. And now the rest of the episode that's gone.
Yeah. And I think the thing that's really interesting and something that you're gesturing towards is that, and this comes up with regard to Gabriel, right? Like Gabriel's not someone who's usually making pierogies for like feeling bad. Right. And Elizabeth is not someone who is typically like acting on her like emotions or rather like on these moments of her own vulnerability. Right. She's like so often trying to like guard against any of that and guard against any emotions like entering their way into her spy work. And so both the Gabriel pierogi scene or just both the Gabriel pierogi situation and just Elizabeth feeling guilty in general feels generally out of character for those two and yet like fits into the arc as we have seen it develop over the course of the season.
Whether or not vulnerability is weakness or a strength is a huge theme in this show and particularly with Elizabeth's character where, you know, in prior seasons to this, it was really Philip is the one who is sort of, you know, breaking ground on is vulnerability something that I need to be a complete person? And like, in order, like, is vulnerability not a weakness, but like a strength or a necessary component of my humanity? And now Elizabeth was kind of like hand waving that away for most of the show up until this season. And all of a sudden now this is something that is very important to Elizabeth and she didn't intend it to be important. And she's having to grapple with that on an accelerated timeline.
I mean, I guess I'm not 100% sure Elizabeth is actually grappling with it at all or that much. Like, I think in some ways, like, the point or the conversation about Elizabeth is usually the one weaponizing guilt or the way that other people feel or the way that she understands other people to feel against others. And, like, I think she has relatively little experience, like, doing a lot of that self-grappling or self-reflection. So, like, I think that when we see Carrie Russell's face, like, after she has all of these intense moments or these intense conversations, like, what the thing that sticks in my mind is her, Carrie Russell, like, stealing herself as Patty in the car before she goes to like, confront Don, and especially as she's then walking out of the front door, that, like, actually it's Elizabeth kind of floundering rather than grappling with what's happening for, like, the precise reasons you all are identifying. Like, when she does the grappling with emotions work, like, she wants to kind of reinsert it back into cool or cold or calculating, and then it's moments when she cannot do that that, like, I think she is at her kind of most adrift or most disoriented. Like, I think about even very, very early in the show when she has memories of being sexually assaulted by one of her trainers with the KGB, or I think about as well, like, some of the season 3 challenges she had with, like, having sex she doesn't want to have as part of her job. Like, there's these kinds of moments of, like, disorientation for her that I'm not sure always open up to, like, the more emotionally complex work of grappling with or dealing with. That, Jordan, I think you're right, and Danielle, I think you're right, that Philip is trying to do in some way, in some level.
So I guess the difference is maybe, like, maybe grappling is the wrong word. Like, she's not actively working through these things in the way that, like, maybe you're trying to describe. It's more that she is experiencing things in a way that she had previously been able to sort of section off. Like, she's no longer able to compartmentalize in ways that she used to be able to. And that's scary and new for her. So even if she's not having sort of the emotional language that, you know, maybe you say Philip gets from Est or from, you know, his different working through of things, I think she is starting to go through things, for lack of a better term, that she had previously not gone through, and she doesn't have the vocabulary or frame of reference to be able to talk through and describe.
Yeah, and I think you're right to sort of push on the whether or not she's actually grappling with it. But, like, I do think, and I think we're all in agreement, she's being confronted by a reality which was not a reality she, like, is used to living as a spy, right? And, like, I think there are these moments where it's, I'm just thinking about when she says to Paige, this is either in the last episode or the episode before, where she's like, well, we would, like, go to Russia, right? Like, And then Paige has like a huge reaction to it. And like,
of like, wait, haven't you actually thought through any of the logistics of this and why this doesn't make any sense at all? Like,
Paige makes a lot of sense. Home?
Yeah.
She like loses her mind.
Are we taking Henry? Henry.
Is Henry on this show? Actually, he's more on the show this season than he has been in seasons past. But that's because like Stan needs a new kid.
That's funny.
That's one of our favorite jokes is that like Stan is actually Henry's daddy.
Yeah.
It's not an inaccurate observation.
It's not wrong. Are there other things about Elizabeth that we want to hit here?
One other thing I'll point out that like to both of your points so far. One thing that this episode does really well to, I think, illustrate or demonstrate, use with Carrie Russell acting this out, like the way that she's attempting to experience whatever it is she's feeling, I think that that is indeed a useful way to frame it, is like the multiple pivots she has to make, like, in that she can still engage like peak operator spy mode with Don, like confronting him. And then like, even as she is barely able to like put herself together to go do that. And then Carrie Russell gives us that look immediately once she is out the door, like in the moment, in the room at the door, like she is perfectly able to use your language, Jordan, like weaponize guilt against Don, right? Like she's still like, regardless of what she's feeling, able to do that. And like, that is one of the most consistent characteristics of Elizabeth, is that she always seemingly has like operator mode available to her, regardless of whatever else is happening and she's grappling or failing to grapple with.
I think that's right. I think that her ability to maintain operator mode is getting strained to like almost the breaking point at this point. Yes. And that's a difference from previous episodes and seasons.
Absolutely.
That whole scene is just like, Carrie Russell is doing such great work in that whole scene. Like, it's really amazing. Like, when she's like the genuine pain that's on her face as she's watching young He take the children to the car. And like in my mind, what she's grappling with there is she's like, these are, you know, this is throwing into relief. Like, these are the children's lives I am about to destroy through my upcoming actions that I'm about to take. You know, it's a lot. You can rationalize, you know, doing things to adults, you know, if you're a spy, a lot more easily than rationalizing pain to children you were doing the pepper dance with at dinner. You know, I mean, like this is a whole nother level, I think for Elizabeth that she wasn't prepared to have to deal with. And like for her to go into that and then, you know, and then, like you say, she flips that switch, you know, I love that little, I won't upset your perfect little lifeline she throws out there as a dagger, you know, to sort of foreshadow the later deception. And then I actually had a question for you guys, because I picked up, or like I had, in to me, in the subtext where she said, after, she, you know, Don is telling her to get an abortion, when she says, I'll take care of it myself, did either of you get a subtext that she was trying to convey to Don that she was going to induce an abortion on her own? Because the reason I picked up on that was, at least from what I had seen from her character, she's not supposed to have, like, she does this Mary Kay thing, but she doesn't seem to have a lot of money, as best as I could tell. And, this, you know, the whole, I don't want anything from you, I had sort of read that as she might, you know, sort of be going, you know, outside the system on this and trying to intentionally increase Don's future guilt at not trying to stop her without clarifying what she meant there.
I mean, I hadn't picked up on that, but I like that point because it makes the like showing up of the quote unquote family like make much more sense, because it's like she gave herself an abortion that's like much more dangerous than going to a doctor, at least at that time. You're not just like getting pills in the mail these, you know, in the 80s, right? Like it is much more dangerous, more grotesque probably. So that point makes a lot of sense given like where the episode goes, but it was not something that I picked up on. So that is an impressive pull.
It might be reading too much into it, certainly, but I was just, my thinking was
no
like,
such thing exists on this podcast.
Again, are you sure you are not a political theorist?
One of our few official stances is that overreading does not exist.
Yeah.
Perfect. I guess to me, like, and we'll come back to this later, is that the ultimate thing that they do in order to try to get access to this codes is actually like not at all an assured mission. And so I think that like here, the goal from Patty is to try to create as many points of guilt contact, so to speak, in order to increase the likelihood that Dawn will, you know, leave the fake stepmom and dad in the room alone. And so that's why I think I was reading into that is like, oh, she wants to create one more possible source of doubt and guilt in Dawn.
I had not considered that before. I really, really appreciate that reading.
Yeah.
Because it also opens up the Dawn clearly didn't read this as such, I don't think, in the episode where quote unquote Patty's family comes later on. But like, is it possible that Elizabeth as Patty is trying to suggest to Dawn that like taking care of it herself might also include suicide, right? Like that's another possible reading that gets opened up that like she at least wants to leave open the possibility that Dawn could in that moment or after the fact read it that way.
Right. The idea that like, you know, that combined with I won't mess up your perfect little life, she knows that he doesn't want to mess up his beautiful, perfect family and perfect life. And so like it makes total sense to lay that groundwork like that.
I think that that's right. I love that. I mean, I also think that that brings us to talking a little bit about how when the family shows up, they put the pressure on Dawn and how they use guilt to do that, right? Like precisely this point, like she's dead. You pushed her to do this. Like you are like the causal factor here. Is like you should feel guilty about this and your guilt should like push you to be shoddy about your like work decisions, which is exactly what it does.
Right. Like how could you possibly be so rude as to like care about security protocol at a time like this?
Right.
And like, it is like, when I was watching that, I was like, boy, this is like a massive gambit. Like, yeah, this guy is distraught over what he's done, but like, he's also like the head administrator at a massively secure, you know, bio research facility. Like,
yeah, questions about how massively secure it is.
Okay,
we will get
what
into.
What is supposed to be a very secure, in theory, you know, bio research facility. And so like that was a pretty big gambit for that to have worked. But again, tying back into our theme, it's about weaponizing that guilt. And they felt that was giving them a strong enough chance that Dawn would feel bad enough in that moment. And that's what that led up to.
I mean, yeah, especially because, I mean, Philip, like Dirtbag Phillips' character of the brother and then Gabriel and Teresa, I forget what Gabriel's moniker is supposed to be here. But like all of them play different shades of guilt tripping through anger. Like Slaya, each of them plays it slightly differently with like Philip the most overtly hostile or aggressive, but there's just like this cutting edge to both Teresa and Gabriel's like confrontation or presentation to Dawn that like makes it work so extremely well on him that he does like, yeah, I'll let these two strangers sit in my office unsupervised for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, like, to go to the ATM?
Too many minutes.
The whole, how could Dawn plausibly think that there's an operation going on here? You know, you know, Gabriel's delivery of you killed my little girl is quite convincing in that situation.
Yeah.
Well, it's the same. I mean, it's the same thing that they're playing on with regard to Martha for four seasons of this show. They're overlooking someone. They're in some kind of like non-conventional role, like, or there's this tiny opening, like the thing that the KGB is so good at is like making a small opening into something larger. The problem is that, as we have seen, and I'm interested to see what happens with this, like it often comes home to roost at some point, right? Like the Martha stuff, the FBI bad at their jobs, but eventually figured it out. And so it'll be interesting to me to see if there is like if there is backlash with regard to this and how that sort of like how that unfolds.
And there's an added layer of tragedy on that count, in particular for Elizabeth, right? Because we even found out in this episode that they didn't find the codes to level 4 at this facility, right? And so, like, okay, they're going to take the, like, storage, like, computer storage, file storage, like, data and analyze it. But, like, the mission, like, succeeded in its medium, like, operational sense, but, like, totally failed in its, like, longer-term strategic goal, which, like, I'm assuming we don't necessarily get this in the episode except for, you know, a couple of things that we'll talk about later, but, like, Elizabeth doesn't get the biggest chance to react to that particular news that Philip delivers, that Philip delivers to her, but presumably, given what Elizabeth is experiencing and, like, her conversations throughout this episode and what we've seen of the difficulty she's had with the Young Key Don mission throughout, like, she, I'm sure, is questioning, like, well, was this all for, like, nothing? Like, what did I do this for? Why did I, like, build up the closest thing I've had to an actual friend and then, you know, destroy these people's lives?
I mean, this is bad enough for Elizabeth if everything works perfectly. Yeah. If this was all for nothing, this is all the more crushing for her. And I mean, that I honestly thought that scene where Philip delivers the news to her, I mean, she looks horrible in that. Like, she can't believe that they didn't find the codes there and that she still had to go through with this.
This is like, this exchange is precisely why I feel like, even if it's not full on grappling all the time, where there are these like seeds of it starting, like the kinds of doubt that Philip has had since we have met him in the series, it feels like over the last few episodes, at least with the Martha stuff, with the Pastor Tim and Paige stuff, like with the Young He stuff, that there are these like kernels of doubt that did not exist for Elizabeth before that we're now starting to see, like, not just come up every once in a while, but it's like thing after thing that is like at least cause for questioning, which in the past she just never would have done.
I think maybe Elizabeth is finally starting to realize that Philip isn't just weak for having these doubts. And I think that for a long time was how Elizabeth felt about Philip. Like, you know, he's a great spy most of the time until he lets his emotions get the better of him. And I think that was just kind of her party line for a while. And I think now she's starting to realize, oh, like this, there's something more to this. It's not just weakness. There's something going on. And like, I too am a person, in fact.
We won't say any more, but I think that like that's a useful thing, Danielle, that Jordan has pointed out for you to think about going forward, is like, what does the end of season 4 mean for the Philip Elizabeth relationship moving forward? And I think Jordan and I can speak no more.
I'm treading extra cautiously on cryptic remarks because I forget what order some stuff happened in. So I don't want to say something that I think was season 3, but turns out to be season 5.
No, we love cryptic remarks. We collectively, not Danielle individually.
Listen, the thing is, didn't we? I maybe talked about this after the last episode, but like there have definitely been times where people have totally like expose things and I just don't pick up on it because I'm like, oh, maybe I missed that in the episode that we watched, or like maybe I didn't watch this episode like closely enough. And then it's like John's like, oh, don't you remember when like this person said that thing, like that was like a huge reveal, and I'm like, well, I did not catch that at all. So
Danielle's being the kind, the person doing the huge reveals is usually me because I fuck up and give too much information.
I like don't think that this was you though. I think it was someone else. Anyway, I'm just too dense to, and also like my experience of watching this show for the first time is like there is so much going on. So trying to like keep track of all the things that are going on and also think about it like a political theorist and think about it for the show means that like there are, John can tell you before you hopped on, Jordan, I was like, do we even know who Teresa is? Like, do we ever like hear about her? And John's like, oh yeah, like very clear tidbit, which I was like, John, in a million years, I like never would have gotten there myself. So thank God you were here to like, let me know.
I had a question. Was that the 50 to 60 computer expert who speaks perfect English who was referenced in the previous?
Yes. Okay. That's who Tatiana is like, hey, okay. Oleg, I need to find this person. If you've got any leads, send me my way.
You guys are too smart. I don't like it.
I mean, Jordan is a very smart person, and also, like, both Jordan and I have seen The Americans before, so, like, it's a little bit a lot easier to follow this stuff.
I don't know that I would have followed it more if I had already seen it, but I'm happy to blame that for myself. Okay, so maybe we want to transition to talking a little bit about Stan and Oleg and sort of what's happening with regard to guilt there, because I think that's another interaction where guilt is sort of, like, bubbling up.
Yeah, Jordan, I think this is a scene that you particularly earmarked. Like, what stands out to you about that conversation between the two of them?
Well, okay, so first of all, this comes after, or there's a scene sandwiched in between them, but this comes after the scene that happens between Philip and Stan that's at home where Philip and Stan are talking and Stan tells him about Gad being killed. And he's, you know, just kind of talking about the animal KGB and what they've done. And, you know, I've got my little italics of, you know, note Sarah put in here, dramatic irony, talking to the KGB here.
Nice.
But, you know, Stan is just looking haggard by this point. And he's just, Elizabeth comes home, he downs his whiskey, and I, like, turned to Sarah and I was like, do you think Stan's an alcoholic? And she laughed. She's like, of course he's an alcoholic.
1,000,000%.
She was like, remember when he took the six pack home?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. Remember last episode when he came over and just left with a six pack of beer? He didn't ask for the six pack, but he just left with the beer. It's like, this is mine now.
So anyway, there's, you know, he's left and there's like an interim scene, there. And then we cut to Stan with Oleg in the rail yard. And like, to me, this is probably the most momentous scene in the episode for me. I mean, there is so much going on here. I mean, Stan shows up possibly drunk, from the way he's behaving.
I was wondering that as well.
Yeah. Same.
And he has this intense expression and tone of voice from, and I'm forgetting the name of the character, but was it Victor was the name of the KGB agent who he shot in the back of the head in season one?
Yes.
Okay, so to me, the instant he starts talking, I'm like, oh, he looks and sounds the way he was talking to Victor in sort of like a threatening false pally way right before he shoots Victor in the back of the head. And so, like, to me, this is incredibly nerve-wracking. And then it continues sounding threatening, where he's like, you know, there's been a lot of interest in you, Oleg. There's been talk about using Nina, blackmailing you, using your brother against you. Like, this is all incredibly threatening tone of voice and behavior coming from Stan. And then it takes this turn, like, or what feels like a serious turn to his guilt over, Amador's killing. And, you know, then he, you know, makes an allusion to killing Victor. You know, to losing Nina because he's the one who originally worked her, as a source, to Gad's death, you know, losing his wife. And, you know, he doesn't want Oleg on his conscience either. And, like, to me, I mean, this is huge for Stan for a few reasons. Number one, like, just personally, I don't think Stan would have done this, you know, a season or two ago. Maybe he wouldn't have done it a few episodes ago. I mean, he's just in a completely different place. And, you know, Stan is kind of the show stand-in for, you know, rah-rah U.S. patriotism, love of country in a lot of ways. And, like, the U.S. is fundamentally a source of good. You know, if I am working for the government, if I'm working against the KGB, what I am doing is fundamentally good in and of itself.
Yeah.
And I think Stan, in this moment, has gotten to a place of, like, this love of country, love of job, whatever you want to call it, it's not worth killing someone else for this. And, like, I even think, like, maybe going a little bit further, like, he's maybe, whether consciously or not, he's realizing that the end result of patriotism is an endless cycle of violence, because that's all that it's been. And so I think, like, this notion of patriotism is, like, all mixed, like, I don't know if it exists in the same way in his head anymore. And I just think he's in a totally, totally different place than he was a couple of seasons ago. And I just think this is just such an amazing scene. Oleg does a great job with saying very few lines and having to convey a lot without, like, he can't thank him, really. He can't, like, you know, he's obviously not going to argue with him. You know, he's very threatened, but also not trying to give up much to this guy who has power over him. Like, there's just a ton going on here, and I think it's just a great job by both actors.
That is so well said. I mean, I agree. Like, great job by both actors. The Oleg being, like, not having much room to say anything is like done really well from an acting perspective, but also like also does so much work in terms of the show. Oleg is like a chatterbox, right? Like he's like word vomit central. So it's like interesting to get him in this moment where like he is constrained, and the way the constraint is functioning, it's functioning on like his main instrument, right? Like, so I think that's interesting. I also wonder, like, I appreciate your reading of Stan there, but I think the thing that I'm wondering about, and I agree with you, like he's in such a different place, but I wonder if it's not so much like doubting, it feels less like doubting the like the work of patriotism, but almost doubting his ability to impact the broader processes. And I don't think those are necessarily mutually exclusive. I think I was just reading it as like a, the way that his faltering doesn't feel like ideological in the same way as like a Philip faltering does. But I think that you're right that like there is something about that there.
So you don't think that it's more like a doubt in, you know, goodness of America or like the shining city on the hill or whatever. It's more of a doubt in his own capabilities or his own, you know, sense of control and ability to keep people safe. And he doesn't want to take that risk anymore.
Yeah. And I think it's like, it's doubting his ability to control things. For me, that's what the GAD stuff brings up for him. And he's like, I think where guilt figures into this is like, he feels guilty about, for some reason, he feels guilty about the way like all the stuff with GAD went down. He already felt guilty about GAD sort of being fired or like being let go. That was, I think, part of his like emotional palette already. But I think like GAD being killed and like Stan not believing whatever line the FBI gives them to me is about like his own complicity in that, which I think has part of it is about the like America, patriotism, etc. But part of it is also like a question of Stan's own like power and agency.
If I can both end this reading here, yes. Which, if I may, I think that, like, the way that I would read it is, like, I think there's some point of, like, convergence between these two readings that I would frame as a Stan, like, disidentifying or splitting or dividing himself from, like, a pure identification of himself with the nation or himself with patriotism.
Yeah.
Like, he has created the, like, psychological and emotional space and, like, permission structure to not just do the unthinkingly, quote-unquote, patriotic or loyal thing, right? Like, he has, without... like giving up on the broader, like, oorah, America's the best, like, land of the free, home of the brave, like, witness him talking about how much the KGB are animals, or like witness his like scoffing at Pastor Tim being a social justice-y kind of Christian.
No, we
like,
got to come back to that later.
in the very same episode. So like that's how I would read what Stan is doing. And I think that helps illustrator throws light on like the depth of how fucked up Stan is about all of this, that both of you have like pointed out how much this episode brings to a head. And thus it makes me note with interest that the two characters who receive that from Stan are Philip and Oleg, right? So you've pointed out how Oleg's playing maybe a different role than he usually does, like, because he doesn't have much to say, because, like, Costa Ronan just has to kind of, like, play off of Stan, mostly monologuing, right? So there's a little bit of a difference there. And the other person he talks to is Philip. So, like, there's a way in which he's talking to the KGB in both times without knowing it, which I think is just, like, a thing that's worth noting. Particularly because we've seen before with Martha how like Stan's unconscious is better at his job than he is on a conscious level, right? And like, I wonder if the show is like, by even having Philip raise this point himself to Elizabeth, like wondering or having us wonder whether Stan is on any unconscious level going to put together the, I told Philip about Gad and, you know, a couple weeks later, Gad is dead. So there's a way in which like, there's also the, who is Stan making his confessions to? Like he's making his confessions to the KGB, but he doesn't always know it, but maybe on an unconscious level, he does know it.
I don't think he knows it. I like that whole fan, but honestly, I don't think he knows it. Like, I think maybe in season six, we're going to, Stan's going to be like, is it possible that like all these weird things that happen at my neighbor's house are because they're spies? Like last episode, fade to black.
No comment. Danielle trying to get us to comment by not doing this in the dossier. It's not going to work. Jordan's too smart for your games.
There's a lot of good stuff to unpack in what you're saying, John. I do think the intuition question, I think you're right about that, is that a lot of times his intuition kind of leads him the right way, but it's sort of his last resort. I think he has great intuition, but doesn't recognize that that's one of his greatest assets because he thinks it's like a froofy thing that's, you know, out in the ethereal world, and you can't put hard facts and numbers to that. What you were saying about Stan now, I think is correct. Like he isn't not patriotic. He hasn't lost his patriotism, but he is, you know, allowing himself more agency. And I think maybe if not seeing the wisdom of that, making that decision for his own benefit. And I think that that's actually something that's become somewhat of a running theme. We've seen that definitely with Philip with, you know, he wasn't supposed to extract Martha. And, it will be interesting to see how, if that tracks with any other characters in the show, as the show goes on. And I think that it is, that's something to bear in mind, you know?
Just bros broing together and like broing their way like into the 80s. Into what?
To enlightenment.
To enlightenment. Bros broing their way to enlightenment.
Never happened.
An American story.
It's Danielle's opera. She's going to write about the Stan Philip romance.
No, it's the tragedy I've already written. Oh, we love it. We love it. We love it. Anything else on Stan Oleg?
No, I think it's time to go talk about Pastor Tim and Alice.
Jordan, do you want to maybe get us started on this conglomerate of guilty characters?
Sure. So we already briefly, I think, touched on the first scene where Pastor Tim comes over and is, you know, feeling pretty terrible. And Elizabeth is still like, oh, good, we've got him. You know, we've got this guy kind of in our pocket, you know, maybe not quite that strongly, but like, oh, you know, he feels bad about this. How can we use this? You know, hey, Philip, we've got this. How can we use this?
Yeah.
I actually, before we moved on, I kind of had a question on the subtext of what Pastor Tim says in that scene, all the things that being a parent can mean. And he sort of has a real hard beat for that.
Yeah.
And I kind of wanted to reflect and get your guys' take on that.
Oh, great. More reflecting on Pastor Tim. Cool, 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 cool.
Danielle's favorite character.
I love
character.
Any Pastor Tim dwelling we have to do. Disagree.
Well, what does it mean to the other characters, even if we don't care about Pastor Tim?
Thank you for playing along, Jordan. I appreciate it.
Something I am usually unwilling to do. So, Jordan, I think you've surpassed my rank in Not Quite Great Book co-hosts from Danielle's perspective.
Host? Does Jordan host his podcast now? Is that what it is?
It's not what it is.
I love it so much. We're guesting on our own podcast. It's honestly perfect. Honestly, this is the Telos of Not Quite Great.
Oh my God, Danielle, that's the fucking joke I was going to make.
Jordan's like, I don't find any of this funny.
I'm sorry. This was the first esoteric reference to go over my head.
We're making jokes about like ancient Greek and Aristotle, kind of.
Yeah, kind of. Don't worry, you'll get some of it in the cave. Not Aristotle, but another ancient Greek, Plato. Okay, so your question is, how do we interpret the, like, I am a parent of it all with Pastor Tim?
Well, he says he's thinking a lot about them, thinking about all the things that being a parent can mean. And, you know, I think there's a general way to read that, but I'm just kind of curious what you all thought, because I didn't feel like I got it, so to speak.
the first place that my brain went to, and I don't know if this is like correct or helpful, but it went to like Mother Russia. Which I don't know if like that, like, I don't think that that's where Tim was going to, but I was like, oh, interesting that Tim is like, he is interpreting all of the page stuff, like through the lens of these people are parents and have to make decisions about this. And those decisions would be different if they weren't parents. Right. Like, and I also, so it's like one, the other thing I was thinking about is like, my dude, you're not even a parent yet. Like, get over yourself. But I think
Danielle, he's got a whole flock. Like, you know.
Well, this is where I was going to go. I like, he's not, it's not Father Tim. It's Pastor Tim. But like, the children of God, something, something, blah, blah, blah.
So I make that joke, but I actually, so one of my pet theories for this episode, which I've yet to roll out to all of you, I've been saving it, is like, this episode is in part Tim, Pastor Tim's like conversion attempt or conversion narrative in as secularized a way possible towards Elizabeth, right? Because like, they go through the, like, you know, stations of the cross together in their various conversations with one another, proverbially speaking. Danielle's not having that one. And
also,
like,
he's not Catholic. Do non-Catholics do stations of the cross?
I don't know.
No. Have I been, like, when you walk in the old city in Jerusalem, they have all the stations, and it's like, my dudes, we do not, no one needs this. But I lived in the Valley of the Crosses. When I lived in Jerusalem, it's like where they got the wood for Jesus's cross. My very Catholic relatives were very excited about this and also horrified. And I was like, it's called the Valley of the Crosses because they used to put people on crosses all the time. It's actually like not that interesting that it happened to Jesus. They didn't like that. They felt like it was blasphemous.
Jordan's pro-blasphemy. You're good.
Perfect.
Just... He's just another dude who got crucified.
Yeah, literally. It's like, that's what they did to everyone. The weird thing is that he came back to life, apparently, but that's just because he's a vampire. Anyway, let's move on. John, you were making an actual point.
I had not considered the Mother Russia interpretation. what I was thinking was that maybe this is the first time that he is seeing them as parents first rather than KGB agents first. And I think that that, like, you know, his, you know, near-death experience, so to speak, really threw that into relief. And I think that, you know, yes, he doesn't have a child of his own yet. I think it wasn't so much about thinking about his own child he's going to have. It was more like against the backdrop of, I'm not going to get to see my child grow up. Oh, you know, these are parents and I am on my way to being able to form a sense of empathy with these people who I only was previously having empathy for because of my relationship with Paige.
It tracks with this at least subtle shift, not so subtle. Pastor Tim's not subtle, but the shift that we see Pastor Tim make, like vis-a-vis Elizabeth and Philip, vis-a-vis Elizabeth, not necessarily vis-a-vis Paige, but like the shift that Pastor Tim makes, but also like, again, it is precisely that shift and that like opening that leaves him vulnerable to the kinds of manipulations that like Philip and Elizabeth are going to engage in.
Like if we go back to, I forget if it was last episode or the episode before where it's the meeting between Stan and Adderholt and Martha's dad, where they're trying to convince Martha's dad, oh, well, usually it's, you know, the kind-hearted people that are susceptible to manipulation. Now, present feelings about Pastor Tim aside, he is someone who's not like an evil person and who is someone who would fit into that theme of someone who is able to be manipulated. And so I think that makes sense in that general sphere of like that. This is why, you know, Elizabeth and Philip's eyes, you know, lit up like dinner plates where they're like, oh, you know, here's a snack for lunch that we can manipulate. And they're feeling good about it.
I am mostly with all of that, although I find myself in this odd position of like thinking that Pastor Tim is more canny than either of you two. I think maybe give him a little bit of credit for, because like, I do think he is intentionally and like thoughtfully like, okay, he's always going to be out manipulated by Elizabeth and Philip. Like that's a given, but I think that within that broader context, like, I think he is trying to convert Elizabeth in this episode. And I think he's trying to do so by playing to a, like, recognition of Elizabeth's own canniness. I think he's doing it by, like, occasionally buttering up and, like, paying obeisance to Elizabeth and Philip and the, like, things that being a parent can mean as part of that. And I think that it's also in that there are so many times in this episode when Pastor Tim gives Elizabeth a religious answer that he then immediately couches in secular terms. And I think he's, like, trying to, like, reel in Elizabeth just a little bit. I'm like, it's never going to work or whatever. But, like, I think that Pastor Tim is so committed to what he understands his vocation to be that, like, this is his attempt to assert agency in the situation, is to do a secular conversion of Elizabeth as much as possible. And, like, on some level, it has already worked. Like, yes, Elizabeth, Paige, and Philip are manipulating the entire situation. And also, like, I think there is something genuine about the way that Elizabeth goes to Pastor Tim multiple times in a religious space. And it's like, I think the thank you that she gives to him and the, like, now, you know, we have gotten closer thanks to you, is manipulation and also genuine at the same time as Elizabeth is dealing with her stuff. It's like, I just think that there's a lot of ways in which Pastor Tim is, like, much more a gentle person in all of this.
I mean,
and doing so, like, in a particularly, like, pastoral way, quite literally.
I don't disagree. Listen, I don't disagree with the, like, I hadn't thought about it as, like, Pastor Tim converting Elizabeth, though I like that read. I think the way that I was thinking about it is, I wasn't thinking about it in exactly the same vein as you, but I was thinking about Elizabeth going to him multiple times as a kind of, like, the Elizabeth's version of a parallel to Philip's Est journey. And, like, this is a moment like Elizabeth, like, she goes to Pastor Tim. Yeah, there's manipulation there, and, like, I always have to be working him because I have to, like, sort of see where this ends up. And also, like, she's really fucked up over the Young He stuff. And, like, so she goes to him in part because she is feeling so guilty about Young He. So I think, like, yeah, there's manipulation there, but I don't think that this is, like, a black and white. I mean, this is, like, you're the truest boltest of ands. Like, it's both that, like, going to him allows her to, like, work him, and also that, like, he is someone who has a set of skills that actually are helpful to Elizabeth in this moment. And, like, I don't know, it makes sense to, like, offload it there. I don't know. So I agree with you. Like, the canniness of Pastor Tim, he's a Victorian ghost. He's not
Danielle
canny.
Refuses to.
You all just went through, like, half my notes on the episode, so now I don't know what to do. I'm gonna throw in, to your point about the conversion, I hadn't thought to think of it as an explicit conversion attempt. I think that's not an incorrect reading. I think it's a little more subtle than that, but I see where you're coming from. I do have a note. I have a note from Sarah here. When Elizabeth goes to the food bank, you know, Pastor Tim suggests she could come help next time. Can't manipulate the manipulator. So I think that, like, that is an attempt that, like, that is kind of a funny moment from Pastor Tim when he is actually trying to pull a fast one on her. And it's, like, a little fun moment that the two of them have where it's like, yeah, we both know you're not going to actually come do that, but I just had to throw that out there anyway. To go back a little bit, sorry, you covered a lot.
Don't get us started on good old Pastor Tim.
I hate him.
You all should meet Sarah, or Danielle, you should, because Sarah has multiple negative things to say in her notes about Pastor Tim.
Great.
First off, Pastor Tim has the worst wig of the bunch, which is a million percent.
Totally agree.
No doubt.
I have called. I don't know if I did this in the last episode, but I generally refer to Pastor Tim as a Victorian ghost. So if Sarah wants to take up that moniker around Pastor Tim, happy to give it to her.
He's so pale. And I'm an extremely pale-ass person, but, like, Pastor Tim.
But There's something about the Pastor Tim's paleness and also his wig that both just scream, I'm a Victorian ghost.
Agreed. I want to go back just because how my mind works a little bit more chronologically. So back to like the first time that she goes back to the church, this is after Philip and Elizabeth have talked about the Gad being killed, and she goes and, you know, and after Philip has obviously come over at the beginning of the episode to apologize. And, you know, there's sort of this question of, is she working Pastor Tim or is she feeling feelings? And it seems like the agreement here is that it's both at once.
Yeah.
And, I think she's feeling them and she's still in this space, at least at this point, where she's able to feel things with it, with an agenda. And like that line she delivers really, really well, where she's like, I just really felt like I was coming apart. Like she's taking what she identified in the first scene. And now she's really trying to twist that. She's really trying to hone in on that and to be like, oh, you know, by the way, you know, subtext, you helped make me feel like I was coming apart. Make sure that you hold on to that guilt that I'm, you know, while I'm attempting to express some honest emotions, because she obviously was extremely anxious about what Alice having this tape could do to the family.
Yeah.
And like, this is, you know, possibly laying the groundwork, you know, maybe we'll come back to this later, but possibly laying the groundwork for, you know, can we get the tape back or can we get Pastor Tim to do something with the tape? So like, that's kind of like that first, her going just alone to Pastor Tim, where she's using some of these emotions. And, spoiler alert for season 4, Game of Thrones from 10 years ago. John and I used to talk about Game of Thrones all the time. John has had an amazing circle of smugness that has come around with Game of Thrones, because John stopped watching Game of Thrones in, I think,
what,
like
circle of smugness, generally speaking.
No, I knew that this is what it's going to be about, because you and my dad have the same, it's the same thing. We've talked about this before.
So like John read the books and he like, I think he stopped watching like season 4, and then
that
he was like,
I don't want
spoilers. I'm waiting for the books to come out. So then like when obviously George R. R. Martin decided he was never going to write another book again, I felt super smug about it. And like John had made a really stupid decision, and then the show finished and the show finished incredibly disappointingly. And so then he got to come feel very smug for not getting super invested in it, like all the rest of us idiots did. And so like, I just am really happy that John could feel that way.
John regardless. And Sean Hanley, my dad, who's like, Tyrion needed to lose a nose. He didn't lose a nose. I will never watch the show again. It's like, what are you talking about? Who cares?
I support that take so strongly.
I know, we've talked about this.
But anyway, I was meandering, all which is to say, season 4, anyone need to pause the podcast if you want spoilers. Tyrion's on trial. Cersei has been trying to rally support against Tyrion in his trial. She goes to see Oberyn and is talking about how much she loves her daughter and how much she misses her because her daughter is in Dorne. And so like, she's having this bit. Wonderful role for him. So great. She's like feeling very, very emotional and like indicating this to Oberyn. So then Oberyn then in the subsequent scene goes to Tyrion and says something to her like, you know, she wants me to, you know, vote against you in the trial. I think she didn't even realize herself that that's why she was there. And then Tyrion says, paraphrasing here, letting honest feelings do dishonest work is one of her many gifts. And that is the phrase that I kept popping back into my head about Elizabeth throughout this episode, and particularly with Pastor Tim, is like, she previously was just a fantastic actor, and now she's allowing these honest feelings to, you know, she's there's a lot of things going on where on one hand she's we won't use the word grappling to upset John, but she is going through something and allowing herself to feel some feelings here while also realizing how much of a benefit that can be in the present situation as she's attempting to turn this situation with Pastor Tim to her benefit. So then after Elizabeth finds out that the codes weren't found, mm-hmm. you know, she goes and she checks the messages on the payphone and she listens to the voicemail from Young Hee, which is one of the most devastating scenes in the entire series for me. It's just
gutting.
so hard to watch. And you're watching Elizabeth here, and there's nothing in the world she wants more than to talk to Young Hee, than to comfort her. And she can't do it because Patty's dead. And she knows in this moment she may have just destroyed far and away her best friend's life for nothing. And like this, she, and I think the best part of the choice of the director's choice or the writer's choice in the scene is that she can't listen to the rest of the message and she hangs it up. Now that goes back to John's point of how much is she actually grappling with this because she can't actually feel all of the feelings and she can't process all of it because it's all too overwhelming and too much. But like, this is probably the lowest point that I can remember up to this point in the series that Elizabeth has been at as her character. And so like, this is where now it goes into, she's actually going back to Pastor Tim a little bit, seeking advice. And like, yes, she's absolutely working him. And she is indeed still going back to let those honest feelings do dishonest work. But she asks for his advice and asks how to not ruminate on bad thoughts, essentially, you know. And so, you know,
I know nothing about struggling with
that. Yes, no, absolutely not. No.
I'm only ruminating on bad thoughts. What's a good thought?
And I think this goes back to what you said last episode, Danielle, which is that her relationship with Young Hee took her by surprise.
Yeah.
And she wasn't prepared for that.
I did
and
say
she's
that.
Now still grappling with it was great, and it was a great insight. And now she's still grappling with that. And she's still like, how do I deal with this emotion that I was not resourced to experience now?
Yeah.
And so she asks Pastor Tim, and Pastor Tim says, "I pray." And I just like burst out laughing.
My dude. This was the best
line of the episode, because it's Elizabeth's deadpan. The shot on Elizabeth's deadpan face after that is so freaking perfect. I just like couldn't handle it. And like she says, and so she's like, okay, well, like, you know, what if you don't believe in God? You know, what if you're not religious? And then he says, none of those things matter. All that matters is how we treat each other. And like, there's two things about that. And I think this goes back to John's point about this is like at least a partial, you know, sort of maybe there's a little conversion attempt going on here, but whether it is or not, I think there's two other things going on here. One, like this response from Pastor Tim is like a genuine surprise to Elizabeth. I don't think she was expected. She has a notion of what a pastor is going to say to her in this moment. And that did not track with what she thought a pastor was going to say to her. So that's number one. And number two, like there's some, in one sense, there's a comfort that Elizabeth is getting some advice couched in secular terms that she can relate to here.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, this is the worst thing in the world she could have possibly heard in this moment, because the way that she's just treated Young Hee is irreparable and it can't be fixed. And she's feeling terrible about the way that she treats people. So she doesn't need to hear that the way we treat each other is what matters, because that is the fundamental problem. And there's no reconciling that in this moment.
No notes, man. Like, one, you remembered something I said. I didn't remember it. No, but I appreciate your point, because like, I appreciate this analysis of the sort of Elizabeth, Pastor Tim, Young Hee conglomerate. I think the fact that she goes to Pastor Tim after the phone call is like the important part of all of this, right? Like, to me, that is her seeking something and seeing an opportunity like through which she can further a connection that is like useful and important to her/her family's survival. But also like, she does not know how to feel. Not only did like the Young Hee relationship take her by surprise, I think, and we see this in the exchange she has with Gabriel when she finally does ask, when she does like say, yes, please ask for a different way to do this. But it takes a couple of times of Gabriel asking this a few episodes ago. I think like, not only does she not know how to feel, but she's not used to feelings being part of like her spy work. And so it's like all of those things together, she is, I suspect, feeling really out of control. And so Pastor Tim is like, talking to Pastor Tim is a way to feel a little bit more in control. One, because she's in her mind, I think, working him, but actually like something useful in terms of like emotional, like relationships is also coming out of that discussion.
I like that endpoint, because it highlights something we talked earlier about how easily Elizabeth goes into operator mode, right? Like, and so she's, I think the like going to Pastor Tim is a place where she knows she can like run game is, I think, exactly right. I also think that the constant going to Pastor Tim, which happens three times, right, in this episode, mm-hmm. is additionally, like, a sign of her disorientation, like, emotionally, because, like, in no universe can there be any other reason to go to Pastor Tim for her except for to, like, run to be a spy. And so the fact that, like, there is even a semi-genuine, like, yearning or searching for something is, I think, just indicative about that. And, like, this goes back to my conversion narrative tinfoil here, because Pastor Tim, like, gives – I actually really loved their conversation. It's the second time, and it's, like – it also interestingly placed in this episode, because it's like we see the early part of the lab mission and then they cut to Pastor Tim and Elizabeth, and that I thought was notable. But this is like the conversation where, okay, they talk about like they've, you know, ended up finding one another and ended up in each other's lives, and that's actually turned out a little bit okay. We've gotten closer thanks to you. And here's like secular conversion attempt one is Pastor Tim gives the "that took faith." He leaves it hanging and then says "in page," right? So he gives both the like religious but then secular reading, right? Followed by like talking about how, okay, so Elizabeth feels she's a little bit out on a limb here, or Tim asks Elizabeth if that's how she feels, like, and then he says, "None of us are in control. There is something greater." Elizabeth asks him if he means God, and he just says, "I believe," right? Which, like, again, that works totally, like, in a religious register, but, like, what is Elizabeth's belief in the idea of the Soviet Union, if not, like, an eschatological, like, religious sense, like, of belief, like, in the absence of, like, actual experience or fact or something, right? And then there's the scene that you're talking about at the end where it's, like, what if Elizabeth doesn't believe in religion, God, or prayer? And Tim is like, it doesn't matter, right? So there's all of these places where that's happening. And, like, there's actually, I think, a way in which this is a really, like, deep exploration of what belief or faith means to Elizabeth in the Soviet Union vis-a-vis this emotional disorientation. And I will shut up, but I want to point out one more thing. The lighting of Elizabeth in the bathroom when Philip comes back to tell her that they didn't get the codes, that the mission did not achieve that particular goal, is like, to overread that one, Elizabeth is like bathed in like religious angelic light. Like, that was just like a very, very striking to me lighting choice. And I couldn't help but like slot that into my broader, like, this is the Pastor Tim attempts to convert Elizabeth episode.
I'm done.
Okay.
First off, I'll buy everything you've said except for that.
Yeah, same. I'm like in except for that part.
Second, I totally,
well,
when
she,
I was,
she's
when
we, bathed in holy light and dressed in all white. Like, what the fuck do you want from me?
Get out of here. I'm sorry. Get out of here.
Second thing, I totally skipped that scene earlier, so I apologize for that. So please edit this so it seems like I didn't skip that scene. That was a really good job with, so like where she goes and, you know, crashes his file rearranging, the whole, like, there's a good bit of humor. I think this is probably the funniest, Pastor Tim episode.
I agree.
In the series,
the bar, like,
he's
is the
got
floor.
Quite a few deadpan lines. The bar isn't the floor, but he's got some good lines here where she's like, "Oh, you can't choose your neighbors. Can't you?" I'm going to lean into John's whole conversion theme here, but I'm going to turn it on its head and talk about Elizabeth instead converting Pastor Tim, where she said,
like that.
Where she or using faith,
true Hegelian dialectic by Jordan right there.
after he says "can't you," she says, "We didn't choose each other, did we?" And to me, there was like a very clear, like, divine hand being suggested in her argument there. Because if you're a Christian and you're believing that, you know, God has a hand in everything and everything happens for a reason, well, that's a pretty darn good point that Elizabeth is making. And she's using, and she just does an amazing job of, again, belaboring my Game of Thrones point of using honest emotions to do dishonest work. Where she is talking how threatened she felt, how afraid she was of losing Paige, but it brought us closer together. And all of those things are absolutely true. And that vulnerability is endearing her to Pastor Tim more and more and making him more likely to trust her, more likely to, again, feel guilty about the way that Alice threatened them, and, you know, potentially laying that groundwork down the line. And that that when he says that took faith, and, you know, in that sort of, whether you want to interpret it religiously or a general sense of, you know, if you believe in the Soviet Union and shared struggle and what have you, like the idea of general belief is going to be something that can be appealing to a large swath of people. Her face there is like she's giving like that sort of skeptical eye roll, but that type of subtext of, well, I guess you kind of may have a point there. Again, fantastic face work this episode by Elizabeth. And then that whole, there is something greater than this. And she says, you know, how do you know? I don't know. I believe. Side note from Sarah, Pastor Tim, all caps, sucks. So that's
for agree. You. Full agree.
Well, Danielle and Sarah do need to hang out, apparently.
I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. Are we new best friends? Great.
And then I just had that final note of, like, I think this is at this point in the episode where Elizabeth's credulity is strained to the max at that point. And she's like, I can kind of play along with the rest of this, but, like, your conversion attempts have gone a little bit too far at that point, I think.
No notes on either of you guys, except for the, like, end of John stuff. Also, like, fuck Pastor Tim, just like always. I hate him. It just means that we're going to have to deal with him for longer, and it's like...
I think that I would, and here, and you're not going to like this, Danielle, going back to that food bank scene and, you know, talking about, you know, none of those things matter. This is how we treat each other, et cetera. That entire, that exchange with Elizabeth, I think that this entire scene is both a deepening of Pastor Tim's character and our audience's understanding of him and, you know, him not being as dogmatic as we might have been led to believe, as well as, and for lack of a, you know, actual term, unnarrowing of Elizabeth's understanding of religion. And it, you know, has forced her to, like, come outside of her comfort zone of, like, you know, and I want to come back to this in Glass, but, like, the way that, you know, she had come to understand, what it meant to be religious, because she had a very dogmatic perspective of, this is what religious people are like, and, like, they're all absurd, and they're all a waste of my time. And so, like, I'm sorry to say that, like, you know, without knowing anything about future episodes, it seems like we're being set up to feel more strongly about Pastor Tim and complicating his character.
I don't love that. I don't love it at all, but I think you're right. And that makes me mad.
I love when we're thinking about Elizabeth and we're thinking about how she's changed, how she feels about religion, is I go back to, I don't know which season it was. Maybe it was two, maybe it might've been three. It's after Paige reveals that, you know, to Pastor Tim, who her parents are, and then they have the meeting, and then they bring the Jesuit priest along.
It's this season.
To that meeting.
Yeah.
It was this season? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Four and five. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So they bring the Jesuit priest along, and he's, you know, explaining, you know, here's the cost of American imperialism, and, you know, here's, you know, these, you know, death squads, and, like, here's the good work that these other people, you know, these organizations do that are actually, you know, loosely Soviet affiliated. And so, like, we're seeing, like, a, you know, lefty, you know, more Soviet sympathetic side of Pastor Tim. And, like, this is all an operation in order to try to, you know, convince Pastor Tim that, you know, they should keep Philip and Elizabeth secret. And so, you know, at this point, Elizabeth's, you know, relationship with religion and with pastors and whatever is pretty darn clear. One of my favorite Elizabeth deliveries in the entire show is right after the end of that scene where Philip asks her, so do you think that guy was really a priest? Yeah. And she goes, I don't know.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I burst out laughing. She could not give less of a shit if he was actually a priest. And it's just, that's a wonderful, wonderful delivery there from Carrie Russell.
Well, and also, like, it's such a nice, I think this is maybe where we wrap up the main discussion. We'll move into the segments in a moment. But I think it's, like, it's a nice note to end this main discussion on, where, like, we have spent a lot of time thinking about, like, whether or not this is a conversion effort, what, like, the religious stuff means vis-a-vis Elizabeth, and, like, the
last... Was Elizabeth bathed in holy light?
She was not. Get out of here. Literally,
I watched too much Young Pope last summer. Like, I don't know what you expect from me.
John, literally get out of here. But I think, like, the last time a priest was in play, Elizabeth could not give a shit whether or not he was a priest. It's like a funny juxtaposition. So, stuff for us to think about. Okay, let's go to the segments, and we start with the dossier.
Do you have any Pastor Tim thoughts?
I'm just angry that my one Pastor Tim thought is I just feel like he's not going to be a real ghost anytime soon, and, like, that sucks. I just feel like We were setting him up to be
dead. This is a major shift, yeah.
Oh, we were setting him up to be dead for so long, and now I just feel like this motherfucker's going to be around for forever. Him and his bad wigs and his ghostly pallor. It's like, get out of here. I hate him. My other, like, crazy theory is that I think that Gabriel is now banging Teresa. Listen, the last time I had a theory like this, it was correct. So, like, this is where we are.
That's true, Jordan. Danielle did pick up on the fact that Tatiana and Oleg were going to start fucking, like, and then literally the next episode, they started having sex. So
I was like,
I didn't call that, so great work.
I do want to say, this feels like a dossier point. John asked me last episode, who did I think were going to be the, like, attendees at the dinner party for Seven in the title, and I named all of them, and I texted John when I watched this episode. I was like, what a win for the dossier, and he was like, what are you talking about? I was like, I feel so good that I got something right, because usually my predictions at, like, Pastor Tim will die or Martha will die, neither of them has come true, and that's very frustrating.
Can I ask a leading question for the dossier, or is that not appropriate for this session?
No, that's the most appropriate kind of question.
It's the only appropriate thing.
Danielle, what is your opinion up to this point in the show of William?
Oh, I mean, I think that Glanders does not exist. I don't know why this is the thing John thinks is the funniest in the entire world. I never make John laugh harder on this podcast than when I, like, conspiracy theorize Glanders. I'm like, it's like I'm an anti-vaxxer, but just for Glanders.
That's what gets me.
What do I think of William? I mean, I don't trust him as far as I could throw him, and I'm not that strong, so I couldn't throw him that far. Yeah, I just feel like when he was like, don't get me that clearance, like, if we get him that clearance, like, that's not going to be good. I'm suspicious of him, and I have been from the jump. Also because I don't think Glanders is real, but he's just a germaphobe.
Right. Your thoughts have been noted for posterity.
Other leading questions?
No, that was the only one I had.
I have a leading question for you, Danielle. So, like, we get this, like, farewell between Oleg and Stan, where, like, they say, well, I think this is the last time we'll see each other. Do you think they will ever see each other again?
Yes, 100%, because Stan can't quit the many loves. No, but seriously, Stan is, like, addicted to, like, having power over people, and he's going to find a way to weasel back into Oleg. I feel like he's gonna start picking in terms of the Gad stuff. And I feel like Oleg could, like, come back in, or, like, the Martha stuff. Like, there is certainly places where, like, he could reopen this connection. So I don't think that this is done.
All right. What a dossier by Danielle today. We respect her willingness to make these theories.
Thank you. Braver than I would be.
I mean, I don't know how to not do this, so it doesn't feel brave. It just feels like my brain.
We've only been doing it for 2 years, so.
It's so wild. Okay.
Let's go to class, and I think we have to start with the titular dinner for Seven. Jordan, how did you enjoy that awkward dinner party? Is your median dinner party more or less awkward than this one?
You know, our beautiful but reactive dog doesn't allow a lot of dinner parties at our place. So
true.
I don't know if I have a baseline sense anymore. I found it pretty awkward. I think this was actually the best delivery in the show from Pastor Tim came in this scene when he hears that Stan's an FBI agent and he goes, "Lee." It's like sort of that was him trying to be a spy and to be, like, unassuming in his delivery. And he just, that was the only way he could do it.
Okay. It's like only a dog could hear him. Yeah.
Prior to that, just to belabor the guilt point one more time, is that Alice comes into the kitchen and is talking to Elizabeth. And here I had a note that Elizabeth is using forgiveness as a weapon rather than giving people the catharsis that they want. Like, I think Alice wants to be chastised a little bit for the way that she behaved.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth is refusing to give her that. And then I really, and I, this was my reading of this. I'm curious to hear if it's the same, where she says, if I were in your situation, I probably would have done the same. You can read that as Elizabeth trying to appear empathetic. I prefer to read it as she's trying to plant this insidious seed in Alice that she's got some unsavory KGB-ish tendencies in order to make Alice feel really uncomfortable. Yeah. Like, oh, that's what a KGB agent would do, and that's what I've done. Like, I'm not such a good person.
I wasn't thinking about it precisely in the KGB inflection, but certainly that there's, like, it's delivered in a really sweet, calm way, but there's, like, a you should be afraid, like, bubbling underneath it, and which I think, like, Jordan, you're hitting on the same thing.
I support the mind games reading of that particular discussion between the two. I think that my favorite two moments of this scene were, one, the look that Paige and Philip give one another when Henry, like, biggest Stan fanboy in the whole world, like, second surrogate dad, really, like, more of a son to Stan, is, like, so excited and announces that Stan's there and staying for dinner, and Philip and Paige just have this briefest look between the two of them that is just perfect, and, like, it's not overplayed, it's, like, done subtly, but you can't not notice it, especially it's, like, a rewatch, and the second is just the, like, the awkwardness of you have Henry trying to impress FBI agent Stan with the fact that Pastor Tim has been arrested for being, like, chain linked to a fence, to being, like, tied to a chain link fence at a anti-nuclear weapons protest.
Oh my God. Oh man.
Stan's face made me so, so happy in that moment where, like, just, you know, Mr. Cynical FBI agent butts up against a band of bomb protester, and I was tickled at that.
I just think, like, the whole thing is so funny that, like, that everyone except for Stan and Henry are in the know at that table, which is just really funny. And
it is,
like,
wild when you actually say it out loud.
I know.
But the other thing too is, like, and this is what I love about Stan, is he doesn't even pick up on the fact that, like, it's awkward that he's going to be there. He's just like, no. He's like, oh, no, I don't have to. But, like, he's walking in and sitting himself at the table, and he's probably already served himself food. It's, like, just, he's so dense.
He already got his beer. Like, no worries.
Yeah. He's so dense, and it's just really funny.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, that follows the Oleg scene, and so he's just desperate for human companionship because he's lost his
bro.
Kind of a tiny bit friend, Oleg.
100%. But luckily, he gained bro Philip back with racquetball. So we feel great about it.
We do. The fact that Henry, like, to your point, Danielle, that Henry and Stan are not in the know, and yet, and that's, like, Henry inadvertently diffuses the tension of the situation by getting them on the track of, like, the social justice commitments of Pastor Tim's church, because, like, that steers the conversation away somewhat ironically, like, from the many ways this could go terribly wrong for the Jennings.
Totally. Good job, Henry. Any other dinner party thoughts?
No, I think we move then towards the end of the episode and think about the concluding scene. Both the conversation that Paige and Elizabeth have as they walk towards their car, and then this attempted mugging / assault that leads to, like, talk about operator mode Elizabeth, like, punch a guy, disabling him, and then, like, mid swipe of the switchblade, like, catch it and, like, jab it into the guy's fucking neck, and tear is, like, cut his neck in half.
And it felt excessive. The killing the guy felt excessive. And I said this to you guys before, that, like, if Paige didn't know that her mom was somehow mixed up in the spy community, or, like, you know, a killer for hire, this would have been the moment where she was like, excuse me, you're a travel agent? Like, what? So good that she already knew. But, like, this just felt excessive, and it also felt like a way, I don't know, the way that I read it is, like, this is Elizabeth acting as a function of her guilt more than acting as a function of necessity in the moment, that the, like, violence was one of her outlets.
I think that's definitely possible. I think the way that I read it is that you have here the overlap of spy instincts, like, well, if I'm in a fight with people, like, I'm going to kill them if I possibly, if I, there's any chance I need to do so, overlapped with, like, protective mother who can kick anybody's ass. And it's like, you bring those two things together and, like, was it excessive in the moment? Sure. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like, you know, you shouldn't go around killing people, but, like, I think that fair. Elizabeth, like, couldn't do anything other than kill at least one of those people when she saw that one of them had a knife.
You can argue whether the showrunners needed to set it up that way. But once that scene had been set up that way, I think that guy was going to die.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you guys are right. I just, like, I think the excessive force was just surprising to me.
On that question, and Jordan, you kind of raised the question, like, did the showrunners, the writer of this episode, director of this episode, need to set it up this way? I think what it does to connect, Jordan, what you just said to Danielle's point from earlier, is that it, like, heightens the tensions or the contradictions for Paige specifically, because there's actually, like, a very good moment of, like, connection, but still, like, spy connection between the two of them on the walk to the car. And now Danielle, like, yes, they know, she knew already that Elizabeth and Philip were spies, but now she knows they're not just spies who are, like, trying to do good and promote human rights. Like, so there's still a layer of revelation for Paige. And I think that, like, that's why, like, that potentially excessive force, like, has a role in the emotional dynamics of this episode.
I think it actually was important, and I'm going to once again go back to something Danielle said last episode, which is, you said something to the effect of, Paige is smart, like, so she should already know that her, like, how can she not know that her parents kill people? And I think that I don't agree with that. I don't think she really don't think she had thought about it that way. And I think that, like, she had allowed herself to be, you know, lulled into this plausible deniability of, like, sure, they're spies, and sure, maybe they've had to do some underhanded things, but these are my parents who love me, you know, I want to believe the best possible interpretation of this. And this graphic extended death makes it very clear that her parents are on a completely different level than what she had previously appreciated and what she thought it was that they had done, because I don't think she had wanted to allow herself to imagine what the worst could possibly be. And, like, I really like the detail that they add right in the very last moment there, which is that Elizabeth has the presence of mind to take her purse back, making it very clear that she's not rattled and that this is something routine for her to think through in this situation. And so, nice. I yes, it was graphic, and yes, it was, you could argue, was excessive, but I still think it was an important step in Paige's understanding of who exactly her parents are. Game of Thrones reference, Paige has some serious Amelia Clark eyebrows in that scene. Yes. She's watching her mother stab the guy in the neck. Well, that's all.
I mean, I feel like now is a good time for you to give us your development of Paige's character, like, sort of gloss.
One of the things that I absolutely freaking love that the showrunners did, that they did with Paige's character, that they decided to do with Paige, and, like, this goes back to maybe it's season two again. I don't remember because I didn't rewatch. You have this trope, and you have a very common thing in film and TV. This child grows up in a very conservative Christian household. They hit their teens. They start, you know, they'll have some sex, do some drugs, start drinking, you know, discover their skepticism, whatever. So, of course, in this a-religious Soviet family, the way that Paige rebels is that Paige starts going to church.
Yeah.
And so, obviously, your teenagers are going to find a way to piss you off. But in this case, like, it's actually fairly wholesome and productive. And it's like a socially activist church. And, like, really, her parents don't have a leg to stand on being angry with Paige for her decision to start going to church, other than the fact that it is threatening to their sense of identity and their worldview. It's just turning it on its head from the way that your conservative Christian parents might be threatened if you are going out and having that type of worldview where you're pushing back against their conservative Christian values. I think it's hilarious. I love that they did it. I love that it has taken Philip and Elizabeth this long to come to terms with it. And Elizabeth is finally, like, despite, you know, the still trying to work Pastor Tim, is actually kind of finally starting to come around to it and starting to come to terms with it. So I just, it's there has been throughout the show so much humor packed into that. There's been a lot of, you know, character development packed into that choice. And it's like one simple choice that at some point the showrunners decided to make by just turning that trope on its head. And I freaking love it.
Well, and it's also, I love that point. And it's also so funny because, like, it fits so well into the, like, Philip and Elizabeth are Soviet spies. And, like, what is, like, if there's something, like, so counter to the Soviet, like, communist ideology, like, it's religion that is, like, counter to that. So not only is it's the opposite of how she's been raised, but it's also the opposite of how she's secretly been raised. And so, like, the fact that it fits both those roles is like, very funny.
It's like they were prepared as part of their cover to have their kids, you know, speak English and be kind of Americanized and a little materialistic, but, like, wearing a crucifix and getting baptized is, like, a bridge too far.
And to add on to that, I think that one of the other tropes they avoided in this is to specifically have Paige go and become a member of a kind of lefty social justice adjacent church. Is when it would have been very easy and on some level made sense in the Reagan 80s to have her go to, like, an evangelical, fundamentalist church.
Yes.
But it actually, like, heightens precisely those contradictions and tensions that both of you are pointing out, that it's like, we're doing anti-nuclear activism and we are trying to support, like, liberation theologians in Central America who are being murdered by, like, U.S. sponsored, like, gangs of militias and stuff like that. Like, that actually makes it so much richer than it otherwise would be to do, like, a worse version of this plot.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's do some silly stuff. Starting off with my favorite. Yeah, Jordan.
Sorry, can we take, like, a 2 to 3 minute break? I was just supposed to do a WhatsApp with Will, and I just want to tell him that we're running a little long. And so, yeah, just can I just give me just a couple minutes and I'll be back.
I think we'll be done in 20 minutes.
Okay, yeah, we were just supposed to talk in, like, 20 minutes, so I just wanted to message him real quick.
Okay, we've got a bunch of silly stuff, maybe, that I'll run through. I'm going to run through all the silly things, and then I'll turn it over to you guys if you want to add anything. But just the silly stuff that I, like, saw in this episode. So first of all, like, male robot back, and in a pretty important place.
We love male robot.
I have a question about that. First off, was that a real technology that was used in offices in the 80s? Did I miss
honestly, Jordan, a great question that I have never even thought to ask. I hope so.
I'm going
to
do a bit of research on this while Danielle runs through the rest of Glass Silly
stuff.
We
will come back to this question because it's a great one. We've already talked a little bit about this, but also, like, pierogies as, like, the guilt food that Gabriel makes is very funny. Gabriel the cook always makes me laugh. Also, everyone is just wearing burgundy, and they all look mostly great. And then finally, Stan is having a real bad hair day. Jordan, before we get back to Male Robot, any silly things you want to add in Gloss?
I'm assuming this has come up because, like, it seems... There must be some really deep metaphysical meaning to the fact that Henry is never, ever present anywhere. And, like, I'd like to try and understand why Henry only exists tangentially in the show to play video games and to talk to Stan and to be a foil for other characters. What I want to know is Henry sort of a Gendry rowing perpetually to King's Landing through multiple seasons? Last Game of Thrones reference.
First of all, please don't stop making Game of Thrones references. I'm really enjoying them. Second of all, we, like, joke around about the Henry stuff, but, like, I do think by the end of the series, we are going to have to maybe grapple with the absence of Henry and what that means. And what that means for, like, the Soviet version of the American nuclear family. But it feels like too heavy a topic to get into at least on the East Coast, 9:46 p.m. on a Monday. But I love the sentiment.
I will stay Danielle's sentiment there, and I will report back that according to a Vanity Fair article from 2018, there were such devices in the FBI and or CIA, and the Fields, and I'm quoting directly from the article by Esther Zuckerman. Mm. Fields and Weisberg first read about male robots in Christopher Lynch's The CI Desk, FBI and CIA Counterintelligence, as seen from My Cubicle. And as of 2018, when the show was shutting down, the plan was to turn the male robot prop into a functional male robot for the FX offices.
Okay. Well, asked and answered. John, maybe you want to take us through a couple of camera shots?
Oh, yes. Three camera shots. One, we've already discussed Elizabeth's light situation in the bathroom. So I'll point to two other ones. One is like the camera work around Elizabeth as Patty before she goes into the Seong house to like confront Don finally. It's like a trope that the Americans returns to over and over again, but they do so like just infrequently enough that it's effective, that they are very adept at like raising the question of, is somebody who is doing surveillance themselves being surveilled by the camera work and like the way that they shoot a particular scene, and the like placement of the cameras vis-a-vis Patty / Elizabeth in the car, like is them doing that once again. Mm-hmm. So that I really appreciated. And then Jordan, you pointed out like the Oleg and Stan scene as one of the central components to this episode. And I agree as well. And like visually speaking, that like the way that Nicole Cassell, the director for this episode, frames the two of them when they shake hands, like against a nearly empty, like dark background, but kind of an angle from below that like emphasizes their height, that like really frames like questions about their humanity, even in the visual language of that particular shot, which is difficult to pull off when they're in this kind of like slightly like desolate, decrepit background. I just thought that like that whole scene looked incredible, and that particular shot of them shaking hands was uniquely effective. That's what I got.
Nothing to add. It's great.
I know. I'm like always impressed at the way John like pays attention to camera angles, because I'm like, who's that character? So I just always
appreciate it. I've seen this show like 3 or 4 times.
I know, but I
think I've.
But you are someone who is like, and I know this from writing with you, like you're so good at attending to detail. And I just like the camera angle stuff in the podcast always like makes me marvel. So take the compliment.
I don't have any smart big picture thoughts anymore. So all I can do grasp on details.
All right. Let's get away from self-deprecation and move into borrowed nostalgia for the unremembered 80s.
Jordan, are you able to relieve Danielle of her immense burden?
I do not know what this is a reference to. I was told I could not Google it, so.
Fail.
You can Google it now. You just can't tell Danielle.
Okay. I won't do it right this moment.
Thank you. Okay. Well, that's a fail. All right. First thing we've got is faulty lab security.
Yeah, it just seems like this is an extremely 80s situation, in that, like, we've remarked a number of times upon how, like, it's easier to do a spy show set in the past than the present because of, like, of the ubiquity of, like, surveillance mechanisms, cameras, facial recognition, cell phone tracking, all of that kind of stuff. And this was, like, I think a prime example of that.
Agree. And, like, also another prime example was a couple of episodes ago when Glanders Williams sent a rat in a canister. Same faulty lab security happening there. We've got a lot of like 80s tech, specifically floppy disks, and then Teresa's box.
Yeah, Jordan, like, please explicate what do you hypothesize?
She takes this giant gray, what looks like an original Nintendo system out of her bag.
Yes.
And then I don't know what it is or what she's doing with it. I'm assuming it's like either an old school external hard drive, if they even had those back then, or it's something else related to extracting files from Don's computer.
I think she's copying the disks in it. I think that's what she's doing.
Because she took disks out of the desk, I think, and put them into the computer. So is it that she's copying, she's taking those disks, like looking up what the info is on them, deciding if they're worth copying and then copying them? This happened very quickly in the scene.
I don't know, but it does very much feel like 80s technology, just like a big boxy thing that we're not quite sure if it's necessary or does anything. That seems right. Might have been an Atari, might not have been. We've also got some awkward pregnancy jokes.
Yeah.
So that was so freaking cringy. I just couldn't handle it.
And classically Stan, like, he's the character best situated in the show to make that joke.
Yep.
Or maybe the only person who would make that joke. So, like, it's consistent and, yes, extremely cringy.
Stan, just, like, fulfilling his role of he shouldn't be at this dinner, but if he is there, he's just going to be the cringiest of the cringe.
Yeah. Bun in the oven jokes also just, it gives 80s.
For sure. All right, we've got some fit checks. I would like to call attention to Philip's disguise as Patty's brother, John. And just, I want to, like, celebrate. We love Dirtbag Philip. I felt like this was, like, a real, like, peak version of Dirtbag Philip. But you guys have some, like, decade feelings about this. So please enlighten us. I don't and don't care. But I appreciate that you guys thought really hard
Danielle's
about this.
Danielle's reading us for filth here.
Always.
I thought, obviously, this is a variation on Dirtbag Philip. To me, he was a big Allman Brothers fan 10 years prior to this and then just never updated his wardrobe. So that was how I looked
solid.
At him. You looked at him a little differently.
I read this as, like, this is proto-Kurt Cobain looks from Dirtbag Philip. Like, turn him, yes, more Allman Brothers and more hair metal, but, like, some of the basic elements, like, okay, so the jean jacket's not quite right for, like, Kurt Cobain jean jackets, but hair is actually quite fitting for some Kurt Cobain looks. So it is indeed, like, staunchly within the 80s, but it's the 80s prefiguring the worst possible version of Kurt Cobain.
I love both of you guys, but you are thinking way too hard about Dirtbag Phillips' costume. I just, like, that's it. I'm sorry, but, like, I guess we could linger on Dirtbag Philip a little bit more. Or not Dirtbag Philip. Philip's burgundy turtleneck. Sorry. Philip is always already a dirtbag.
Yeah, I did love that turtleneck. And actually, there are several characters in burgundy throughout the entire episode. Paige has a burgundy dress on during the dinner. Elizabeth has some burgundy on early in the episode. I think when she gets back from the scene with Don and Young Key, or sorry, 3, 2, 1. Yeah, and several of the characters have great burgundy fits here in this episode. Paige has a burgundy fit during dinner. Elizabeth has a burgundy outfit early on in the episode. They're just looking good.
Yeah, I mean, like, in my brain, it was like burgundy, red, communism, but that's just like...
That's as far as my brain got to, don't worry.
John and I share a smooth brain.
Yeah.
And then, we've talked about this a little bit, but I think, like, worth referencing, like, Stan's whole dinner party, like, vibe, not really a guest, becomes a guest, all of that, but, like, his fit, just, like, it amplifies that vibe.
It's quite literally the fit of the jeans that gives it away, yeah, as well as the, like, sweater.
A little, like, yeah, schlumpy. All right, let's go to minor character of the week.
Dad jeans.
Yeah. Let's go to minor character of the week. Jordan, you and I have the same minor character, so I'm going to give you the honors of telling us who it is.
Minor character of the week is Teresa Rawlings, a.k.a. the fake stepmom of Patty, who is in the spy scene where they steal from Don. As I think we discussed, this is the female computer expert 50 to 60 who speaks perfect English, who Tatiana was looking for from the previous conversation with Oleg. The reason, and this is played by, I don't know if I'm saying her correctly, Marceline Hugo. Nice. And I kept looking at her and I was like, what is it about this woman? Like, why does she look so familiar? And then I lost my shit when I looked her up. This is Kathy Geiss from one of my favorite shows of all time, 30 Rock, who plays the absolutely bonkers daughter of Don Geiss, who was the head of GE, who then comes in and she barely speaks. She's obsessed with unicorns. She puts toy cars in her mouths. I can't really do her character justice through a simple analysis of her actions, because she really this her performance really knocks it out of the park for the absurd character that she plays. But I was just so happy that I was seeing her in another role and being made to think about 30 Rock, because I love that show. So props to you, Marceline.
Nice. I've never seen 30 Rock, but like that's a great pull.
I do love that. So I didn't make that connection, even though I did watch 30 Rock back in the day, but I couldn't place where she was until we went to look up who the actor was for this episode. And then what hit me over the head is, of course, she's Gladys in season one of The Leftovers, which is just like a really difficult fucking role to play. And she like kills that role, and is like really, really intense in a kind of beautiful and fucked up role. So shouts to Marceline Hugo for that as well.
I also have not seen that show. Just another set of shows that Danielle has never seen here on The Americans. I think we have made it to the cave.
Hell
and
yeah.
It is, as it has been all season, Play-Doh season. Jordan, apologies in advance for making you suffer through this, but
apology, you know, is also a Play-Doh joke, for the record.
Exactly.
I mean, I get it, but barely.
We're going to make... Okay, so this is what we need from you. John is going to scroll through...
Currently scrolling.
So we just need you to say stop whenever you want.
Oh. Okay, starting now?
Yeah,
yes,
starting now.
Whenever you want.
Stop.
Okay.
All right.
Now I need a letter from you between A and E. So A through E is all any letter in that range.
D.
All right, Jordan, you have brought us to book 6 of The Republic.
Oh boy.
We are in 486D. And here we've got our boy Socrates and Glaucon are talking about philosophy. All right. So, let's see.
I hate book 6.
Here is Socrates to start with. Let us never then admit a forgetful soul into the ranks of those that are adequately philosophic. In our search, let us rather demand a soul with a memory. Most certainly. Further, we would deny that what has an unmusical and graceless nature is drawn in any direction other than that of want of measure. Of course. Do you believe that truth is related to want of measure or to measure, to measure? Then, beside the other things, let us seek for an understanding endowed by nature with measure and charm, one whose nature grows by itself in such a way as to make it easily led to the idea of each thing that is.
480-60. Okay.
Danielle really hates book 6 of
the It's
Republic.
Mostly just like the philosophy books are just boring to me. Though I do think that there are some interesting ways to connect this to what's going on in The Americans. So I'm just going to take the forgetful soul with a memory, like that juxtaposition, and thinking with like the dinner party, and also just like how much they wish that Pastor Tim was a forgetful soul, right? And yet he is a soul with a memory, and they can't quite get out of that conundrum. And so like it just keeps coming back. The fact that he is a soul with a memory, he knows what Paige has told him, and he's like not, he doesn't shy away from it, right? That there's something about that. And I feel like it's also connected to this idea of truth, which is like such a crucial thing within Socratic and Platonic philosophy, like the sort of endeavoring after truth and the connection between truth and reason and wisdom and logos and all of those things. And yet, in the world of spies, like, is there ever truth? Like, that's sort of a question. Anyway, that is my clumsy attempt to connect this book 6 passage to all of the stuff that's going on in The Americans.
I'm willing to also make an attempt to do so. So on the soul with the memory part, I think that, like, there's a Pastor Tim connection in here, but not necessarily via Plato himself, but rather via like the way that Neoplatonists, like Christian Neoplatonists, like reinterpreted Plato, like in later time periods, because yeah. that would that would transform, like, the understanding of the soul. And I'm not going to do a whole, like, what I would do for students of why is the soul very different for Plato than the way we use the word soul today. But just to, like, say that those are two very different things. And I think that there's a sense in which, like, Pastor Tim would be very interested in the Christianized version of Plato's, like, soul with a memory here. So I think that's, like, one sort of connection. Then the other is, like, this very end of the passage when they talk about, like, let's look for an understanding endowed by nature with measure and charm, one whose nature grows by itself in such a way as to make it easily led to the idea of each thing that is. So obviously there's, like, idea, eidos situations happening here and, like, form stuff that's happening here. But there's something about, like, that it says the soul whose nature on their own terms is supposed to turn themselves, like, to look towards the ideas, which is, like, notable vis-a-vis Paige and some of the ways that, like, we've discussed how Paige does or doesn't fit into, like, the narrative with Pastor Tim or the narrative with her parents, that, like, Paige has to have her soul turned to the idea of spying, to the idea of the Soviet Union, so on and so forth, when, like, her soul would, like, naturally, with its own measure and charm, like, be let itself be easily led to the idea of something other than where her parents want to lead her soul to. That's my, like, overly elaborate,
like, that, though. I mean, I like that. I like the, like, pushing the where you started, like, the pushing us to think about, like, what a Christianized, like, what a Christianized republic or, like, some of these ideas, how they enter into, like, the how they get sort of, like, spun around a little bit from the Neoplatonists. I mean, like, the place that I was thinking is that I think Pastor Tim would be completely amenable to a, like, Augustinian City of God reading of like the soul. But you're, yeah. Listen, there's a lot here. We've already belabored it. Let's do some theory ships.
Yeah. Jordan, you have come to us with a theory ship, so we invite you to share it with us and the hordes of listeners.
Okay. It was like 3 o'clock, and I was like, fuck, I don't have anything for this section. Like, I'm just, like, racking my brain trying to think of anything, and so I have a really, really clunky theory ship that I'm going to bring in here, so I apologize for how incoherent this is.
You just listen to us, you know, me more so than Danielle, make extremely clunky Plato connections, so you're all good.
I'm going to ship Hardboiled Wonderland and the End of the World by Haruki Murakami for Elizabeth. We're going to just temporarily ignore...
Great theory ship.
We're going to ignore Murakami's Men Writing Women problems just for the sake of this shipping, so... I think so, and I've read this book last like 12 years ago, so like okay. I barely remember this book. But like basically it's this narrator who's a calcutech who's employed by this quasi-governmental the system who uses his who allows his subconscious to be used to encrypt data. He then finds out that he's going to be essentially losing his conscious mind, he's going to be lost in his subconscious, and like he is essentially he will be lost, and it's the book alternates between, you know, his conscious mind and his unconscious mind, which is Hardboiled Wonderland. And so I'm shipping this to Elizabeth, and, you know, it could be shipped to more characters than that, but I like this idea of, you know, how this giving himself over to the system will affect him is not a consideration for him until it's too late. Similarly to the fact that Elizabeth has already given up so much of herself, it is now too late to a certain extent too late. She has lost so much of her own identity to, you know, let's call the system the censor here or what have you, that now she's lost her best friend. She doesn't have the resources to understand what she wants or needs. That wasn't a consideration for her by herself or by the center prior to this. So maybe this book that really focuses on this sense of self, of this sense of, you know, what is my conscious self need? What wisdom am I missing from my unconscious self that is being lost here? Perhaps she would find some solace in this novel by Mr. Murakami.
That was amazing. That was really good. Brilliant.
You killed it.
I haven't read that Murakami yet. I think we share love for Wind Up Bird Chronicles, Jordan.
You did let me borrow that several years ago, and it was great.
Yeah. I love that. But, like, random aside, is that, like, do we think that book influenced the show Severance?
Ooh, I hadn't considered that. I'm going to have to go back and reread the book now.
Based on a book.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, so Severance is itself based on a book, I believe. But I don't know what book.
We love some on-air live Wikipedia-ing.
I'll do my theory ship while you are...
I don't know if we've talked much about Severance, but I was enamored with season one and thought it was amazing.
Oh, I loved it.
I'm sorry,
actually,
Daniel.
This is a prestige TV show that I have seen and I do like, so... Also, I'm, like, totally in the pocket for Adam Scott, so I'll, like, watch anything that he's in. John, do you have an answer on this, or...?
No, actually. Okay. It was, like, a worked-over screenplay several times by the main, writer, Dan Erickson.
Mm-hmm.
But no reference on the Wikipedia page itself. Other than to say that influences, and, like, this is cited, so I feel fine saying this, the existential hell and the Sartre play No Exit, the totalitarian dystopia and the Orwell novel 1984, film influences were Brazil, Dark City, and Playtime. Other films influencing included Office Space, Brazil, The Truman Show, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, but I do not see any direct novelistic influence.
Okay. A great pick, though, nonetheless. Okay, my theory ship is... This feels mean. Derrida's The Politics of Friendship, because do feel like... I mean, it's mean to make anybody read Derrida, and this is definitely my second Derrida theory ship this season.
You're just preparing us for Derrida season.
We will not do it. I will not allow it to happen. It'll just be like taken back to grad school and it will be bad for all of us. But The Politics of Friendship, I mean, I just feel like there's like something very interesting happening. I'm gonna ship it to Elizabeth, but also I think also to Stan. Just like thinking a little bit about like power dynamics, friendship, like ways to trouble that, and I just feel like let these motherfuckers read Derrida.
I support the ethos of that very, very much. I'm also going to ship something to Stan here. It's going to be not as smart as Jordan's or as cruel as Danielle's. but it is going to be, I think we're just going to give Stan a whole bunch of liberation theology and like also maybe some like James Cone happening here, just because I want Stan to have to confront the fact that like his notion of patriotism that leads him to scoff at Pastor Tim and his like lefty-ish church. I just want him to be confronted and have to like grapple, or not grapple as the case may be, with the existence of alternative traditions that he might not know anything about. So we're going to make him read a bunch of liberation theology and also some James Cone.
Great.
Danielle will also be reading liberation
theology. I was just like, I don't even know what you're talking about, but I feel like I need to. So, okay, cool.
Like, take two parts Catholicism when one part like world systems theory Marxism and like you. Smush them together.
It sounds like the worst thank parts you, miss. Of post-colonial theory. I would like the best parts of post-colonial theory. Thank you very much.
I think you meant to say put two influence into Mexico and one into Panama, John. Sorry,
that's
John.
That's for the real heads. We're going to, if you know that reference, send us an email, notgreatbookstv@gmail.com. It'll make Jordan and I very pleased.
I don't know.
I will Venmo $5 to someone who can say what that reference was to.
I will not be emailing or getting Venmo'd because I have no idea what you guys are talking about. But you know what? Sometimes it's better like that. Guys.
I have two notes at the end of the episode.
Go for it.
Note number one, we got the name of the KGB agent that was murdered in cold blood by Stan wrong. It is Vlad. Rather than Victor. So that's okay. Victor is Viktor Zhukov, who was Elizabeth's longtime mentor.
Yeah.
So like there is a KGB character named Victor, who is important as well. So that's an understandable one. Secondly, Jordan, we began this episode by wondering who among us was Stan and Philip. And like, by being good at the job of podcasting, you clearly are not Stan. Yeah. So you've cemented your Philip status here on the Not Quite Great Books podcast.
I second this sentiment. Like, you can both be Philip, but like, you are definitely not Stan.
And the audience should know there's a whole bunch of the outline that we didn't get to. There's a section called Jordan's Smart Questions. So we're just going to have Jordan back if he will tolerate it.
Yeah. Open invitation.
I had a lot of fun here. It was even, I thought it would be fun, but it was more fun than I expected. So I think
you're very good at it. So you should feel good about that. And again, I don't give out a lot of compliments. I'm a Capricorn.
That's
so
true.
Like, it's the only thing I know about being a Capricorn. Just like mean. All right. We have come to the end of the episode. Before this gets even further off the rails, I'm going to close it up for us. Thank you, Jordan, for joining us. Again, amazing job. And you are welcome back anytime. Feel free to call your shot on season 5 or 6, and we will gladly have you back. Maybe especially
so
somewhere in season 6 so that it will be after I know more things and less like as
it is, I did have probably my favorite part was the Danielle dossier. So I like you knowing less, quite frankly.
Okay. So
well, it sounds like Jordan's coming back in season 5.
Great. Great to know. We will be in touch. Thanks as always to producer Amy. Up next in 2 weeks in the feed, it will be American season 4, episode 12, A Roy Rogers in Franconia. I don't feel good about that title, but you know, we'll get to that a different time. Thank you so much for joining us on Not Quite Great Books,
a TV podcast. Thanks for joining us on another episode of Not Quite Great Books, a TV podcast. It's created by Daniel Hanley and John McMahon, and indirectly, producer Amy. You can find us on Twitter at NotGreatBooksTV. You can email us at NotGreatBooksTV@gmail.com if you have comments or questions that we might potentially read and respond to on air. Subscribe, download, rate, review us, tell your friends to find us at Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, and Amazon Music, and Google Podcasts. We would like to thank Less FM for Electro Trend 60s, which is the music that you heard at the beginning and you are hearing right now. Until next time, go play some racquetball.